You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Today, more than ever in the history of education, credible online master's degrees are of great value. Introducing the Master of Science in Pharmacology program from UCI. The University of California, Irvine, UCI, is ranked as the number 9 public university in the nation by U.S. News and World Report. UCI is noted for its excellent research and graduate programs, an extensive commitment to undergraduate education, and a growing number of professional schools and programs of academic importance and social significance. Fall registration is now open. Apply today at sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology to learn more and reserve your seat by June 15th, 2020. That's sites.uci.edu/mspharmacology and reserve your seat today. The deadline is June 15th, 2020.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation, welcome back to the Pharmacy Podcast. Interesting time in our nation and how fast the month of May 2020 has gone by. Just kind of makes you think what we're all going through together. And as you know, we are trying to interconnect pharmacists with pharmacists and pharmacists with physicians on this COVID-19 and supporting each other. Health system pharmacists are learning now much more from community and community and vice versa. I'm excited to bring us a physician who really has his fingers on the pulse. And today's guest is Amish Adalja. He is a physician, infectious disease, critical care, and emergency medicine doctor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Amish, welcome to the Pharmacy Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm really excited to have you. I don't know if our listeners realize this. I'm sure that you've heard of Amish and what he's doing in the news and in the markets and education. But Amish, you've been everywhere. I've been so impressed. I see something from you almost every day in keeping us informed from another voice. And I think as we've all grown tired of this pandemic and COVID-19, it's refreshing to have some new voices and verified information, and also giving us a contrast between different territories throughout the states. I know I'm in Fayette County, Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh, and it is very, very quiet here. Whereas when we're talking about New York City, Los Angeles, Miami, things have changed, but it's still a lot noisier than where we're from in South Pittsburgh. So just give us an overview of your interest in this, obviously, and a little bit about yourself.
So I am somebody that works on pandemic preparedness, trying to predict pandemics, understanding emerging infectious diseases, infectious disease emergencies, and how all of these types of topics intersect with national security. And I work at a think tank called the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, which is the only think tank of its kind, which was founded in 1997 by the man who eradicated smallpox from the planet. So we've had a strong interest in trying to understand how infectious diseases impact society. And I've been there since I was a training infectious disease physician and have worked on topics such as anthrax and botulism and plague, as well as things like 2009 H1N1 and Zika, and tried to figure out exactly what the best way is to respond to these things, to understand what the best preparations are for them, how to think about these things ahead of time before they become problems. And then I do a lot of media as well, speaking to the general public as well as policymakers as much as I can, because I think it's very important during an infectious disease emergency to have people that are experts in the field, that are trusted sources of knowledge, that don't have a political agenda that they're trying to push out there, talking about what is known and what isn't known, and how to think about what's going on around you.
So Amish, that was very much what stood out to me. You've said that several times on several interviews, to extract and pull away from the politics and come at this specifically as a scientist and as medicine and is hard in fact from what you know. And I really like the balance between your hopeful tone and cadence versus the science that you're bringing to the table. You were recently interviewed, I believe this was posted just this week, and you said that viruses that are eventually, there's a vaccine, it's difficult and rarely achieved to actually eradicate that disease. Give us a little bit more on that thought and why you had said that.
Well, to say that a virus or a bacteria, anything can be eradicated, that's a really tall order. And there's only been one human infectious disease eradicated from the planet, and that was smallpox. And there were special characteristics about smallpox that allowed it to be eradicated. And that program almost failed. So for something to be eradicated, number one, it has to only infect humans. Number two, you have to be easily able to identify these individuals that have it. Number three, it probably shouldn't be contagious during its incubation period. And number four, you have to have a vaccine. If you look at this novel coronavirus, none of those four criteria are met. This is in bats and some other animal we don't know. There are definitely people that can transmit when they're in their incubation period. We don't have a vaccine. And you can't readily identify people who have this because many of the symptoms are very mild and they're completely clinically indistinguishable from any other cause of the common cold or influenza. So this isn't something that we can get rid of. A vaccine is going to be able to control it to a level that it's completely going to be not an issue for us, hopefully. But this is something that's established itself in the human population, just like the other coronaviruses that cause about 25% of our common cold. So we immediately, after realizing that this was a virus that was spreading efficiently from human to human through the respiratory route, there should have been no idea, no kind of pretense about trying to contain this or keep it in different countries, because we know that even when it was discovered at the end of December, and then cases were discovered prior to that in mid-November, that this had gotten everywhere before it was even noticed. That's just what these types of respiratory viruses do. And indeed, we've seen now cases that had been diagnosed in France retrospectively around Christmas time. So this was something that really never was going to be stopped by focusing simply on travelers coming from China.
So you also have some very interesting insight. I specifically want to focus on pharmacists as your partner in all of this and really being able to take the discovery and the orders and the therapy and carry that out, as pharmacists are now seeing their patients 10 times, 12 times more than what a physician can because of how busy primary care physician is right now and emergency care is right now. And you were talking about, on another interview, people taking over-the-counter fever reduction medications and then when being checked for temperature in order to get them past, you know, to come into work or come in doing something that, of course, that temperature isn't showing up. That was really interesting. And I'm wondering what kind of dialogue between community pharmacists when they get a ton of questions from the public and, of course, the information that you sourced and have verbalized, which is a part of this I hadn't even thought about. But I just wanted you to expand on that for our pharmacist audience.
Sure. So everyone knows that when they're infected with the novel coronavirus and you start to get symptoms, that there's going to be a tendency to want to take drugs like acetaminophen or ibuprofen or naproxen to help with those symptoms. And that's definitely what you want to do. But I think it's important to remember that when many of these workplaces, airports, are working on trying to set up fever screening as some way to screen out individuals that may be harboring the virus, that if you're simply taking those medications, you may be afebrile or not exhibiting a fever because you're taking those medications. So I think it's important that people realize that fever screening is not a panacea and that there are ways around it. It's not that people are trying to avoid it. It's just people don't feel well, so they're taking it. And they may not actually mention to people that when they're going through those fever screens, or there may not even be a person at a fever screen. It just might be an infrared camera with somebody watching remotely, that it's not going to pick those individuals up. So it's important when you are doing this type of screening of employees or whoever it might be, that you think about the question of, are they taking ibuprofen or acetaminophen or naproxen, and is fever enough to be able to say that these people are clear to come in, or however, whatever protocol that you're using. So I think it's important to think about me counseling people about that if they're going to places that their fever would be suppressed and they may not be identified. And also for the screeners to ask, are you taking any of these medications? Because then I think it's a different type of screening that you would want to do and not just rely solely on the temperature.
It's a really, really good point. So there have been some other things that you've talked about. And once again, I really think of the reaction and the place that we are in caring for patients, identifying patients with COVID-19 with testing. There are 28,000 pharmacist moms who are part of a very, very quickly growing Facebook group called Pharmacist Moms, led by Susie Solomon, who's a pharmacist in New Jersey. And she's just been awesome through this because she's been reaching out to community pharmacists and pharmacist moms in health system settings and even some compounders and really getting what's happening in the in each of the territories that they have. And that collaboration between physician and pharmacist just seems much more important and actually has risen some of the capabilities of what a physician can ask a pharmacist to do. And I've been hearing of those collaborations. What has John Hopkins done with your pharmacy department? How have things changed since this pandemic started? And what kind of information are you sourcing from them?
Sure. So one clarification, although I'm affiliated with a think tank at Johns Hopkins, I don't work in the Johns Hopkins hospitals. I work in the hospitals in Pittsburgh, so I can speak a little bit about that. Okay. Not specifically to what Hopkins is doing with its pharmacy department, because I'm not involved with that part of it. But I do know that pharmacists, and I'm an inpatient physician, so I have a little bit of a different view. I don't see as much of the outpatient pharmacist, but I can speak to what I think their role should be. But I would say that our infectious disease pharmacists that are in our hospitals are basically full members of the team, that they are the most trusted resources, even more so than some of my colleagues that are physicians, when it comes to thinking about how to treat patients with COVID-19. So for example, we have multiple randomized controlled trials going on with different drugs. So it's really important that pharmacists are part of that team and helping to guide us to help decide what are the best drugs for each of the patients. Even when we're not in a randomized controlled trial, there are experimental drugs like remdesivir, which has an emergency use authorization from the FDA, that it really is essential to have an ID pharmacist or a critical care pharmacist helping you decide how to administer that, to obtain the drug, all of that. And even when we were doing hydroxychloroquine earlier in the pandemic, using hospital-based protocols for hydroxychloroquine, working with ID pharmacists and critical care pharmacists was essential to making sure that you were able to calculate the right risk-benefit ratio for the individual patient. So I do think that they've taken a heightened role because we're kind of in uncharted water with no approved drugs for this. And I would say that inpatient pharmacists have become really essential, even over the last 10 years, become a totally thing unto themselves, where they are really, really valued and very precious resources for hospitals, especially during infectious disease emergencies, not just with this, but with antibiotic resistance and antibiotic stewardship, as well as in HIV clinics. They've really been great. I think that also we have to think about outpatient pharmacists, because obviously there's the issues with hydroxychloroquine, where people, if doctors are prescribing this off-label, that it's really important that pharmacists talk about the side effects of those of this drug to the patients when they are counseling them, when they pick up their medication, if that's actually happening. Hopefully it's not happening so much, because we don't have any randomized controlled trial data to show that it works, but there's been a lot of interest in it because it's been a politicized issue, like many things in this outbreak. The other issue is that pharmacists do administer vaccines. I suspect we're going to see a brisk flu season with a lot of people wanting to be vaccinated, because it's really important. We're going to be dueling with both COVID-19 and flu at the same time. And the more people we can have vaccinated against influenza, the more of them we'll keep out of the hospital and have room for COVID-19. So I do think pharmacists are going to be called upon to do a lot of vaccinations for influenza. And hopefully in states where they've restricted the age group of who pharmacists can vaccinate, I know that's been an issue in the past. And during 2009 H1N1, during that pandemic, there were some relaxing of those regulations and allowing pharmacists to vaccinate younger individuals. I hope that's the same thing that happens during this season, and maybe it becomes permanent, especially as we will likely have a COVID-19 vaccine in the somewhat future, unclear exactly when, but I fully expect pharmacists to be part of the vaccination teams that are doing that, as well as physicians and other healthcare providers.
Amish, once again, you've been a light in all of this, where there's so much information and there's so much frustration from the public about getting back out there. You know, obviously, conspiracy theories come about during times like this. You've been this filter through all of that. Every time I've listened to something that you've said, it's been on point. So just based on the data, since you're extremely data-driven, which is what we need, especially when pharmacists are listening, because they can kind of filter through the buzzwords and the hysteria, the hyperboil. So if you had all the data that you have right now, what are you foreseeing over the next 6 months to 12 months where we have the balance between opening the economy and being cognizant of the virus? Where do you see the timeline where we can actually, in your opinion, have a nice blend between the two so that we can get on with our lives?
You have to remember, and as I said earlier, that this virus has established itself in the human population, and it's not going to cease being a threat to us until there is a vaccine. That doesn't mean, though, that people have to be in economic shutdowns until there is a vaccine. You have to remember that social distancing was enacted in such force because we were very worried about hospital capacity, because people had seen what had happened in northern Italy as well as in parts of New York City, and were very nervous about hospitals having to change their standards of care, moving to what's called crisis standards of care. That didn't happen in New York, and not everything that happened in New York was extrapolable to the rest of the country. So now social distancing is starting to lift in all 50 states. And now the key is going to be, not that we aren't going to get cases. We are definitely going to continue to get cases. We are going to continue to get more deaths. The key will be trying to keep those cases from occurring at a clip that's too much for hospitals to handle, so they get into crisis. And we're already hearing about places like Montgomery, Alabama, getting into a little bit of a problem with ICU bed capacity after they reopen. So that's what the key is going to be, watching cases at the hospitals to see, are they getting to a place where they're unmanageable? And hopefully we've fortified our hospitals, we've fortified our health departments for contact tracing, and we have diagnostic testing in a much better place than it was 2 months ago. And that's how we're going to strike that balance. But every time we step out the door, though, that virus is going to be there. And it's going to come down to more of an individual risk preference decision. What is your risk tolerance? What is your risk aversion? What risk factors do you have for severe disease? How essential is the activity you're doing? Is it easy to social distance in that activity? All of that is going to be a part of everybody's decision-making every time they step out the door. And for some people, it will be back to normal because they're very risk-tolerant. And for other people, they are still going to want to be very wary about social interaction, especially if they're in high-risk groups. And it's not going to be one-size-fits-all, and it's not going to be possible for a doctor to prescribe exactly which activity is safe or which activity isn't, because all of them are going to have a non-zero risk. And it's just going to really boil down to the individual deciding what's best for them, because the hospital capacity problem has largely been solved. Obviously, if we do see flare-ups like what's happening in Montgomery, Alabama, you will likely see some recommendations to social distance again. I suspect that they won't be broad or blanket in nature. They'll be more precision guided based on what the most valuable activity is in terms of decreasing the transmission of the cases based on the epidemiology, feeding whatever hotspot is starting to boil.
I really appreciate that. So what I'm always standing for is obviously that fact. I've heard from pharmacists in different territories and the smaller communities, obviously the frustration of the patients. Patients will tell their pharmacist anything, especially those community pharmacies that have been part of the community for years. And we've heard some really crazy stories about 5G and Mr. Bill Gates and all the ones that I'm sure you're having to filter out based on the fact that you're being accessed so much to really tell the facts to the listener base or someone that's viewing something that you're talking about. Taking a pause and thinking of our hometown, you know, I grew up in Butler County. You grew up in Butler County. I've even heard from a pharmacist that has a community pharmacy in our hometown, the way that the public is feeling and the conspiracies that rise. But what's the difference between a community that's smaller like ours was compared to, you know, downtown New York City? What do you think the balance is between, you know, being cognizant and recognizing the threat, or you know, being too lax, like you said? Is there any difference between how to manage that from a containment perspective?
Well, you have to think, if you're an individual, an average person in New York City, you got hit very hard. You likely knew somebody that was infected. You likely knew someone that died. You saw what the hospitals were like with your own eyes. And it would be very hard to entertain any kind of conspiracy theory when you are just faced with the calamity that happened in New York City.
Right.
Whereas if you were in Butler, where there were cases, there were people that died in Butler, but it was very sparse and there wasn't this big surge of patients. The hospital was largely empty during the height of the pandemic and had some patients with it, but it wasn't that you knew everybody with it, and it wasn't that you were hearing the hospital stressed. So then you say, if you're an average person and you go on the internet and you read about it, then you say, oh, this must be some kind of conspiracy theory because people are really not having these types of experiences in my little town. So I don't know what happened in New York, but it must be some kind of conspiracy on me to do something. And I think that's probably where it starts, is that they think that just because it's not as visible in their town, that it must be not real. And I think that we've gotten to a place where conspiracy theories are something, the first thing people reach to, for some reason. I think that there's a lot of distrust of experts. There is a politicization that's happened that's put people into their own little collective tribes where they don't interact with other people. And that's one of the things I've been trying to do, is go on all three of the cable networks, CNN, MSNBC, and Fox, regularly, because they totally different people view those things. And if you're saying the same thing on all three, right. I think it does add to your credibility that this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is something you need to take seriously. And I think it's been frustrating to deal with the conspiracy theories, because there are many real scientific questions that we want to answer and epidemiological questions we want to answer. But we're spending our time trying to debunk arbitrary conspiracy theories about 5G or Bill Gates or George Soros or whatever it might be,
right,
that have no bearing on anything, and they're actually insulting when you get asked about them, because if you're this expert and you're there to ask to be taking questions, and all of a sudden you get questions about conspiracy theories, it's really a waste of your time. And even to sometimes consider some of these conspiracy theories is to sanction them. And I think that that's also something I found myself having to think about, is when do you even address certain conspiracy theories, because some of them are so ridiculous. But yep, then people may take actions based on them, and you want people to take the correct protective action for themselves. And if they believe this is a 5G tower issue and climb up a 5G tower to disable it, that's a dangerous thing, and you want to dissuade people from doing something right, like that. But I mean, it's sad to say that in 2020 we're still dealing with this kind of conspiracism in unscientific mindset, but that's just the world we live in right now.
You know, I'm a glass half full person. I have hope. I've always been a positive person no matter what. And so I'm thinking, you know, with all the recognition of disease, all the recognition now of virus, it's something that's been, you know, nothing like in our lifetime that we've experienced a global pandemic. I believe in the coming years, we're going to see less of an impact of flu in general, not just COVID, but less, because I think the public now will be aware of things like washing your hands, you know, distancing, being more, you know, sensitive if you have a cold. There are so many people, Amish, that I remember that I worked with 2 years ago, 1 year ago, that it'll never be like that, that they would come to work knowing that they were sick. But maybe it was a beginning stages and they felt like they had to work through it to, you know, do a good job at their job or whatever. You know, there's people out there that just have a good work ethic. However, now you combine that work ethic and the balance between not spreading the germs that you have or the virus that you might have or something. So I think that this pandemic is going to make the public much more sensitive to being good stewards and good community participants in the future. What do you think of that?
I definitely think that's the case. And we already saw it in the early days of this pandemic when our flu season basically abruptly ended when this coronavirus came about, because people started to social distance, and influenza spreads in the same manner as this coronavirus does, through respiratory droplets. So I do think that in the future, people are going to really be much more cognizant of how to limit their risk to these respiratory viruses. And it's going to be for COVID as well as many other respiratory viruses that cause all of our common colds, as well as influenza. People are going to voluntarily social distance. They're going to be much more cautious about large groups, they're going to travel probably less. There's going to be more telecommuting. There's going to be more online instruction for schools. So there's going to be less social interaction in general, even when social distancing is lifted. And obviously mass gatherings are not going to be something we're going to probably see until there's a vaccine. So you will likely see much less transmission, and you're going to just see much more appreciation of how to do this appropriately. So I do think that we will paradoxically end up in a better place with respiratory virus infections after this pandemic, because this is something that no one could ignore. And we will get better at understanding the transmission of these in our individual lives and take actions against them. So, I also think that people will probably be more likely to get the influenza vaccine every year now as well. So I do think that this pandemic is going to really awaken people to the power of respiratory viruses to cause severe disruptions to their lives, and they're going to modify their lives in order to minimize that disruption going into the future.
Dr. Amish Adalja, we so much appreciate you coming on the Pharmacy Podcast. I know how busy you are. Meant a lot to me and to our audience that you take time to speak with us, but so proud of you as a local, someone that grew up in the same community that I did, that you're reaching these heights, and how well you've done. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.